You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome back to Earth Station Trek, a show where we trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between. I'm Charles Kelso, and it's my privilege to introduce the Earth Station Trek crew, Keith Johnson.
Greetings, Earthlings.
And joining us this week, special guest, Mark Maddox. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
What's up, Mark?
Good. Thank you for joining us today.
Nice to see both of you.
Yeah, you as well. Now, Keith, do we have any This Week in Trek this week?
I didn't do any. I was going to clear the calendar for Mark.
Okay, great, great.
Wow.
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, it'll be good, Mark.
Veronica and I have known you for a long time. We back when we were on the convention circuit, we used to be doing conventions all the time. When we were doing puppet shows at conventions, it used to be our bread and butter. And at one point, we were doing like 15 convention shows in a year, and you get to sort of see the same people at the booths year after year.
Oh, yeah. I remember. It was good times, too. Keith, I think you and I met at a dinner once.
Right? We went to, what was that place? It was a place that served shakes and burgers and hot dogs and something like that.
It was fun.
Here in Atlanta area. And that was when I met you. That must have been 6 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that.
It was a long time, like 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
53 years ago, something like that. But thank you so much for having me on the show, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, our co-host Alan set this up, and he had to be gone for a band practice. He had messaged us saying, "Mark Maddox is coming on the show and sent an example of your art." And I sent him a picture back because I had that same photo, that same picture on my wall in my bedroom. I was like, "Yeah, I'm familiar with Mark Maddox."
So Alan couldn't make it. This is his revenge for that time I had to bail from Hulanta. I swear, I'm telling you. It's like I really had vertigo. I swear I had vertigo. It's never forgiven me. So
now you're a big fan of Star Trek.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So how did you first get into Star Trek?
It's weird. I didn't really like Star Trek when I first saw it. I was so young that the things that interested a six-year-old boy or girl was more like the Irwin Allen stuff.
Mm.
Because it was basic. You know, you got a submarine, you got a monster grabbing it and putting it in a headlock, and the guys were rocking back and forth. And it's like this very simple for a kid to go, "I like that."
So you're telling me you chose Sleestacks over Spock?
No, I hate to say this, Keith. I'm too old for that. Sleestack was when I was like 13 or 14 years old. But I do like Sleestacks. But the thing was, is that so when I first saw but I will say this. We were living in Germany at the time. My dad was in the Air Force, and it was a Ramstein Air Base, the Armed Forces television. Mm-hmm. And it was 1967 or 68. We just moved on the base. And the first day that this new show came on, they played Corbomite Maneuver.
Mm.
And I started watching it, and the show starts up, and there's no, you know, Earthling. It's a guy with pointed ears sitting there. And I thought, is this show like from the point of view of a guy from another planet or something? And I sat there and I watched the whole episode, and I really liked it a lot. But Star Trek for me did not connect until, because my brother was a huge Star Trek fan. He became a huge Star Trek fan when we moved back to the United States. And he was like the first Star Trek fan I knew. We did not know that there was a bunch of other people in the world with the new, and he was taking audio cassette players and recording the episodes off the television set. Keith is nodding. Remember? It was pre-VHS, and we would have audio recordings of our favorite shows and movies. And it turns out you say that at a convention, everybody goes, "Oh, wait a minute, I did that too." You know, but we did that. My brother got through about 2/3 of Star Trek in a suitcase that he carried around with the episodes that he had.
Wow.
But at that point, it still didn't catch me until we moved to Tallahassee, Florida, and I was just turning 15, and I did not want to live there. I did not want to move there. And I turned on the television set, and Star Trek came on, and I said, "Oh, at least at least this is on, you know? And I started watching it and I really became a fan. And that was when it was around 75. As a matter of fact, it was right around the month that Jaws came out, but it was a 75, summer of 75. And Star Trek was really gaining traction, had already started gaining traction with the fans, but was now getting a head of steam amongst the fans that would send manila envelopes to each other with fanzines in them and photographs and all this kind of stuff. And it was really a great time to be a Star Trek fan. And it became my thing. It became the thing. I loved it. I was now 14, 15, you know, 16. I was having adult thoughts, and Star Trek was a much more adult show than, you know, than the Irwin Allen stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I really became a fan back then, and still watch it all the time. I go back and rewatch the classic episodes and the original six films and the animated series and whatever else. And I do watch a lot of the other Star Trek, but those are the ones that I always, you know, I need something to pop me out of this mood. Now go put on the Ultimate Computer or something like that.
Right.
Something, you know.
Yeah. So, I started watching Star Trek as a young child. And I've said this on the show before, but it's a show that works on several levels because on the one hand, I mean, if you're a kid and it's people in colorful outfits going on adventures and fighting monsters and firing ray guns and things like that. But it's a show that has so much more going on within it that as you get older, it just has more and more to offer you.
Yeah. It's a very a beautifully written show, especially the first two seasons. I mean, I watch all three seasons, but I'm a huge fan of the first two seasons. I think the first season looks like a bunch of little movies. It looks like Forbidden Planet Part 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. But the second season has got a lot of great concept episodes that just come out of left field. You go, wow, they really came up with a new idea, you know, Amok Time or Mirror Mirror or something like that. And I think it was because a lot of the guys that came from the TV at the time were guys that had written for courtroom dramas and westerns and all this kind of stuff. Now, the guys that came in with the concepts were science fiction writers, a lot of them. Right. But the guys that kind of polished them up were just good at, we got to make this work for the human beings. Mm-hmm. And Gene Kuhn is like a big hero of Star Trek. I mean, Roddenberry said it. He knew how to whip those scripts into shape and make them into incredibly compelling human interest stories. Mm-hmm. And so I just think they flow, man. It's like, it's amazing to me how well they work. I watched Amok Time the other night. My girlfriend watched it with me. She hadn't seen it since probably the 1970s. And we watched the first few minutes and I go, "You're going to want me to turn this off?" Too old. And she goes, "No, let's watch it." And I'm like, "Baby, I love you," you know? And so the show ran and we got to the end and she goes, "Yeah, that still holds up. It's still good," you know?
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Irwin Allen, and of course there's always the compare and contrast. What I always find interesting about Irwin Allen's stuff compared to Star Trek is if you think about his main shows, such as Lost in Space and was he on the Time Tunnel and
Voyage
the Bottom of the Sea, every one of them started out mature and pretty good. I mean, the first 6-7 episodes of Lost in Space is some of the best sci-fi TV I've ever seen. The special effects one is great, but there was some great stuff in there. Dr. Smith was truly murderous. He had programmed the robot to kill people, and then it ends up with him turned into a carrot. And Star Trek, as I'm sure you know, there was some discussion at some points about turning Star Trek into a half-hour Saturday morning show at one point. Thank goodness they hold on. And that's the thing about it. You know, like 3 seasons and got canceled. But, man, that's truly lightning in the bottle.
Well, with Lost in Space, they actually filmed it originally, and there was no Dr. Smith in the first 3 or 4 hours. They actually kind of plugged him in afterwards. But he was mean. He was mean-spirited. You know, he was evil. Absolutely. And I thought that was pretty good stuff. I actually like most of the first season. There's a few episodes they start to get real goofy. But by the time you end in the second season, it's like, I just like watching it because there's a monster that's on the attack for a little bit. Or there's some pretty colors or some goofy machinery. And, you know, but no.
And you know, when you compare, people, of course, always say that the third season of Star Trek, the original series, is the worst. Some say it's awful. I don't think it's an awful season.
No,
it's,
I don't.
It's
think
not
that.
As good. But if no. you look at the overall quality of the original series, including the third season, and mm-hmm. then you compare it to what happened to Irwin Allen's shows, you know, as everybody knows, the joke with Irwin Allen's shows is if you turn on Time Tunnel, Voyage to Bottom of the Sea, and Lost in Space, you will see sometimes the same creature. You'll see the exact same silver face makeup where they look, and they're wearing the aluminum foil things. Yeah. And it really just became silly after a while. I think there was a leprechaun on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yeah, I think that the Irwin.
Go ahead, Charles.
I think the Irwin Allen shows started off as the shows he wanted to make.
Yes.
But he's a savvy enough television producer
sure.
to chase the popularity he needs to keep the shows on the air. And I like both versions of Lost in Space, the serious mm-hmm. sci-fi black and white version, as well as the Dr. Smith and the Robot and Will Smith or Will Robinson version.
Right. Yeah. Right. To me, it's interesting the way you look at Irwin Allen at that time. And I'm going to tell you, I really honestly believe with some of the people like the narrator at the beginning of Lost in Space episodes and all that kind of stuff, I think he was trying to compete with Walt Disney at that point, Wonderful World of Disney, by mm-hmm. making a show, because that show had a budget. I mean, by today's standards, the special effects are like, you know, but at the time right. you looked at that and they had the Lydecker brothers in there. We're going to go up on that mountain and we're going to string some wires and the spaceship's going to come in and crash and we're going to film outside and we're going to build this chariot and it's going to go along the desert. Oh my gosh, we got a real jet pack. You know, they only just had that in Thunderball the same year. Mm. And right. it's like they put money into it. And then all of a sudden something happens with Irwin Allen where things just start, he starts to lose the grip. And it happened in his movies too. He turns around later and he does Poseidon Adventure, huge hit, a movie that I love. Turns around and makes Towering Inferno, a movie I love even more. And then a few years after that, he's making The Swarm. and I don't know if you guys have ever seen it, but
oh yeah.
It's one of those where I kind of liked it as when I was 17 or 18. But I'm fixing to do a podcast on it in the near future on one of the ESO other shows, Monster Attack, and we're going to sink our fangs. It's going to be really ugly. So if you want to see, Anarchy, just watch that episode. But he always started off at a certain level. The only one that started off almost and took like 3 days to get bad was Land of the Giants. That one got bad quicker because it was later. It was like 1969 or something like that. And I still love the shows. I still own the box sets and all that stuff. But I usually end up getting to a certain point and then stopping. Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea is the only one I can watch all the way through. And yes, there are some dumb ones. There's a pirate one, a ghost pirate, and there's a leprechaun. But they did that every once in a while on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. With Lost in Space, it was every week. Here's the next new nutty thing that has absolutely no science fiction related to it whatsoever.
And that's the miracle of stuff. I'm sorry, Charles, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I actually have a Land of the Giants trash can next to my bed. I love those shows. Awesome.
You're not.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, if you look at shows like that, like Lost in Space and Land of the Giants, and then you look at shows that were good but didn't last, like The Invaders or UFO and things like that. Gosh,
I love those shows. Yeah.
You know, Star Trek, the original series, it's a miracle. It's a minor miracle because they still produce three overall good shows. Like we talk about, the third season is not awful. It's got a couple of stinkers. The children's show we eat. Spock's Brain is bad enough to be funny. But if you look at that show versus other shows and how their quality declined, again, it's a minor miracle. We got really great, you know, three seasons, and then it went to syndication and the rest is history. You know?
Well, it was one of those things too. One of my favorite movies of all time is the 1951 version of The Thing. I also like the remake by John Carpenter.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. But the 1951 version is, if you want to hear people talk and you want to see a bunch of people that you would love to be friends with, it's the people in the 51 version. If you want to see great, bizarre weirdness, watch the 82 version.
Yes.
They're both great, but they're both different. But the guy who shoots the monster in the 51 version when he wakes up is Bill Self. And Bill Self is like, he's kind of responsible in a lot of ways for that whole phase in television where kitsch, corniness, ridiculousness came in. It was like Batman was getting ready to be made. And he's like, you know what? We can't do a serious Batman show. They were actually talking about making it a drama. And he's like, nobody's going to buy that. And that was his defeatist thing, is that we got to make it a comedy. Yeah. And then that came along, did that. And then the ratings were so huge that all the other television shows started doing Lost in Space, which was under the control of Bill Self. He was the head producer. Yeah. Even Man from U.N.C.L.E., which started off very serious, got lighter, a little fun, a little loose, and then got really stupid with Robert Vaughn up in a treehouse dancing with the gorilla and all that kind of stuff in one episode. And the final season actually got back to being serious. First, one of the earliest episodes of the last season is him being tortured, and he's screaming and shrieking. And I'm like, holy crap, I don't remember an episode like this. But Bill Self came in and threw a grenade of kitsch into the middle of the from the middle to the late 60s.
Yeah.
And Star Trek got a little bit of that on it, too. And they brought in Fred Freiberger to work on the show. And he was kind of, you know, there's great episodes in the third season.
Enterprise. Absolutely.
Love it. Absolutely. Holy and Webb. Love it.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's Yesterday, or not Tomorrow's Yesterday. What's the one with where it's something Yesterday. All Our Yesterday. Sorry.
Mr. Atos.
Mr. Atos. Yeah, with Kirk and him fighting on that darn cart. He's going to get the orange juice to the patients, you know, and he's just not going to. It's just, you know. But I still love it. There's a lot of great episodes. I remember being a kid and liking all the episodes. But, you know, you get a little older and things are, you know, science fiction's in some ways more serious than ever. You know, we just watched Dune. You can't turn around and watch Spock's brain right after that or Space Hippies, you know, what guy singing songs about Dr. McCoy. But as a kid, I watched it and I liked it, and it was still more serious, even in its lightness, by years, second or third season, Lost in Space.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely.
Well, Batman deliberately went into the kitsch from the start. There was a cleverness and self-awareness to the writing that a lot of the other shows that tried to replicate that format in the wake of Batman's success just didn't have.
Yeah.
Batman, even as a show, offers you more and more as you get older as well, in a different way than Star Trek does. But I think
with Batman, though, is it arced up really high and then came soaring back down.
Yeah, that's true.
Kitsch doesn't hold as well. I mean, I remember that. I did not see Batman, the television series, when it was on. I lived in Germany, and the only thing we saw was that in-between movie that they made.
Right.
That, to me, is what I love the most, is that film. Because it's an hour and a half. They throw everything at you, and you get it. But the show came up and it went down, you know, just because people finally got the joke and they're like, okay, we don't need to see more of it, you know?
Right.
You know, two and a half years, something like that?
Yeah. Three? Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And Star Trek leaned into that 60s kitsch in season three, but not nearly as much as something like Lost in Space did. I mean, I think Star Trek, and even when it came back in the 70s as a cartoon, there was a commitment to the vision. You know, that when they brought Star Trek back, and we've said this on the show plenty of times, so I'm boring people. But I mean, there's a lot of 60s shows came back as cartoons in the 70s as shadows of their former selves, whereas Star Trek came back largely intact. I mean, it was a bit more kiddie than it had been on live action.
There was a few episodes where the Enterprise inflates and scares everybody. It's like, where's your perspective on the, you know, turn on the scanners and see it's a big balloon.
Right.
But that was a pretty darn good show.
Yeah, with the original cast, the original mission.
They had real science fiction writers like Land of the Lost. Land of the Lost came on, and I'm like, I don't want to watch the little dinosaur stuck in a mud puddle again, and they got to get it out. But I left, and I quit watching it, and then I came back one day, and I was walking through the room. My sisters were watching it, and it says, written by DC Fontana. And I went, what?
Right.
Written by, and I started watching it, and it's like, this is real science fiction.
Yeah.
The next week, written by David Gerrold, or written by so-and-so. And I'm like, as a matter of fact, I was in a van with David Gerrold 3-4 weeks ago talking about Land of the Lost to him. And he goes, we tried the animated series. We tried to make it serious. And with Land of the Lost, we were doing science fiction. And it was like, you guys did it. I mean, I got my box sets of Star Trek and Land of the Lost, you know?
Yeah. And a quick story about Land of the Lost. Then I have a question for you. But Land of the Lost, I didn't start watching until the early 90s when Sci-Fi was airing it because I wasn't born when it was on. But I was probably 12 years old.
Born when Land of the Lost is on?
I was not.
We're just going to just cut off your monitor and keep it on.
But I was about 12 years old. I was the right age for it when I was watching it on Sci-Fi. And I would... Right. I became convinced that the Bakuni were speaking a language, and I had a little notebook and I was writing down the Bakuni words and trying to translate it. My brother would make fun of me saying they're just saying nonsense gibberish. And I was like, no, I swear this is a language. And I found out years later, they did hire a linguist who came up with a language of like a 50 word vocabulary, which is smarter than a show for kids, you know, a Croft show needs to be. But that's something about Land of the Lost. You get people like, you know, Larry Niven and DC Fontana and Theodore Sturgeon writing these episodes. It was a show that didn't need to be as smart as it was, but they really put in that effort.
So did you later look at your brother and do that thing that kid does on The Simpsons?
No, because I don't think being right about the Bakuni Land of the Lost is something I need to go around bragging about.
Hey, I remember watching the movie When Worlds Collide over and over again and actually making a book on how everything was going to happen. How they were, what was going to be in the ship and what was going to be, you know, the, you know, how they were going to make sure they got all the animals, all this. I mean, yeah, we've all been there.
Right. The question I wanted to ask you is, why were you in a van with David Gerald?
Oh, I can't tell that story. No. we were at Pensacon and they got a shuttle service and we were out at the beach at our beach hotels.
Yeah.
And there was two or three times and got in the van and David just happened to get in at the same time and say, we get to talk again. Cause I had met him before, but he had written years ago, a book about the making of Troubled with Tribbles, which was the first nonfiction book I had ever read. I had a friend of mine says, you've got to read this thing. Ron Stollenberg, he handed this book to me and he goes, you've got to read this. I'm like, okay. I mean, I've got The Making of Star Trek by Stephen E. Whitfield and I've read a little bit of it. I read that book on the way home in a car from Maryland down to North Carolina, and I loved it. I thought it was, and it actually kind of hurt fiction for me because it was the beginning of me realizing that sometimes real life is more fascinating than stuff that people make up. And I was a huge fan. I still had the same copy. I got David to sign it, and then he did The World of Star Trek. And so we were talking. We were talking about the shows and Sid and Marty Croft and the work on Star Trek and all that stuff. He's a very nice guy, very nice man.
Wow.
So one other thing I wanted to say about Keith, he said two things and I kind of went, red alert. Two things, The Invaders.
Uh-huh. Good show.
And UFO.
Oh, yeah.
Now, here's a weird thing. When I was a kid, once again, I did not like those shows. Every week at the end of UFO, your son died because you sent the plane to fight the UFO instead of getting
that kids. Was a serious show.
I showed that one to my, at the time, I'm not married anymore, my then wife. I showed her the one episode where the son he has to decide between them. She loves human drama. She loves especially Southern angst, gothic stuff. I said, you're gonna like this episode. She'd never seen the show, and I watched it and it was over. She goes, oh my god, that was terrible. Probably the reason she divorced me. But one of those
where, oh man,
later they did a marathon on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah.
And I taped them all and I said, let's check this out. Loved it. It was a complete 180. This show is it's got this slick coolness to it, but it's very serious. It doesn't let you off the hook. And then I went back later, having seen a few episodes of The Invaders, and thought it was a little dull. It was the Quentin Martin sort of effect for me. And I went back and I just bought the box sets about 5 years ago and watched them straight through. And I'm like, I'm completely changed. In a time when kitsch was ruling the airwaves, Invaders did not back down. It stayed serious and straight the whole time. I loved it. Absolutely.
So you watch shows like The Invaders, and not just because sometimes the people in those shows guest star them later, hits later, like The X-Files, but you realize shows like The Invaders that some people don't even remember influence people like Chris Carter for The X-Files. You know, there's so much. Sure. There's influences on Space 1999. There's influences from UFO and other things. And if you look at a lot of the creators and artists they will say, oh, I watched that show. But of course, sometimes it there's a joke. I'm sure you guys have seen it goes over the internet all the time. And sometimes people do polls on the internet. Mm-hmm. And you know where I'm going to go with this. And like the poll, almost all the responses, they don't go any further back than Star Wars or maybe The Matrix.
Know, right.
And it's like everybody thinks everything that's ever existed was influenced by Star Wars or The Matrix.
Yeah, I know. It's weird because the other day I was in communication with John Logan, been nominated for the Oscar three times, right? Writer of Gladiator, Skyfall, mm-hmm. Penny Dreadful, and all that kind of stuff.
Star Trek Nemesis.
We
will hold against them.
I guess this is a Star Trek podcast. We should mention that. But he is a, we were talking and he's a fanatic over Dark Shadows, Count Yorga, The Night Stalker, Blackula. I mean,
I love Blackula. I watch that every year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm a huge one. I love William Marshall. That's probably, I've got three favorite Star Trek episodes, and one of them is The Ultimate Computer. Might be my number one. If I was allowed, Mark, this is God. You can only watch one Star Trek episode for the rest of the year, and you got to pick one, and you can never see another one again. Ultimate Computer, sir. Which would probably be followed by either Doomsday Machine or Balance of Terror, which are oddly enough all ship episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I love those three, but I love Ultimate Computer the most. And it's probably a lot of it is the whole sadness of being taken over by machinery, which seems to be pretty appropriate nowadays. But William Marshall's performance, you know, of this guy who is really a good man, who's just trying to, who has this vision, but is being forced, rammed through to try to make something work. And, you know, finally snaps and, you know, destroy it, Kirk. No, we're invincible. Your mighty starship's four toys to be crushed as we choose.
Well, you do know that show.
Dude, I've seen Ultimate Computer probably 150 times. And yes, that is a real number, but, and another thing I love is William Marshall. Everybody else goes like this when they get the Spock hold. It's like,
yes,
especially that guy in Star Trek, the motion picture when Spock's stealing. It's like, God, that's boring. But William Marshall,
he has this crazy look.
Practic adjustment or something. He did it different. It was different. It's almost like when different people react to things differently. And I always thought that was the coolest nerve pinch scene ever. But I love the episode. And so, anyway, that's the reason I love that stuff.
So how does your love of Star Trek ultimately get into art? And did art come from it? Or is it something that did the art come first and you finally got back around to it?
It's a very interesting thing. Star Trek has come in and out of my life as a muse for art. I started to try to draw with my buddies when we were little kids. Not little, but 10 or 12, something like that. And we loved comics. And so we started aping each other on to create our own comics or draw from other comics that we saw, a lot of Jack Kirby stuff and all that, and other artists. And then, being in the military, you know, families go different ways a lot, you know, they a person for a few years and then it's like, okay, we're being shipped off to some other place, which is always kind of sad. But I had started a little bit getting into Star Trek already, even before coming to Tallahassee. And I started drawing a little bit out of the Stephen E. Whitfield book. They had all those photographs in the middle.
Right.
And then I started, when I came to Tallahassee, I got into a Star Trek club. This is a 1975 Star Trek club, Star Trek Federation of Fans. It was a little branch of a bigger club down in, I think it was the Tampa area. And I was so happy to meet a world of people that loved what I loved. It was great. It was one of the best feelings. It's, you're swimming with the people that you know you're going to be able to have a conversation for 40 hours and not stop. You're going to be excited. And so I started drawing. I moved over from comics, not completely. Every once in a while I still do comic books, but went over and started drawing Star Trek stuff. And then we got a little fanzine, put together. And the only thing that the lady who ran the club insisted on is it was something that was anti, it was a positive feeling word. So actually I named the magazine. It was, she goes, we want something that's positive, not a negative thing, not fire phasers or something. And I'm like, okay. And so I was watching Amok Time and I said, you know, the word Kroika means stop fighting. Hmm. And so that's what we call this little mimeograph magazine. And I did these ballpoint pen covers, you know, with one eye up here, Kirk's here standing, his head too big for whatever. But I was so proud of that stuff. I still got some of those someplace. But if you see them, I have to kill you. And, but it's one of those where it was Star Trek and art melded for me. It was a way for me to communicate that stuff, whether I was drawing Mr. Spock or a green Orion slave girl. But, you know, I mean, just I really loved it. And stuff like everybody lost their mind when the Starfleet technical manual came out. We already loved the calendar and the blueprints had come out. When that tech manual came out, it was an explosion. People were going to the stores. I actually walked up to a friend of mine the weekend that I heard the book had come out and in my high school, and I turned around and I go, "Hey, Billy, it's like, have you heard about that tech manual?" And he's got a stack of books and he pulls it out and we went like high five, like, yeah. I mean, it was so cool. But it was these little minimal things you got from Star Trek. Now you can get as much Star Trek as you want. Oh, you want every episode? You can buy the box sets. You can get the Blu-rays. You can get the 4Ks. You can pay for streaming. You can get every book. You can get them in audio form. But back then stuff was precious. If you got it, you know, the poster books, I don't know, you, Charles, you're way too young to probably remember the
poster. I don't remember them from when they came out, but I know Doug Drexler was involved with them. I have several of the poster books.
Yeah. I mean, I bought all that stuff, but back then it was like a little thing came out here or there. And I kind of miss those times in some ways. Now it's so easy. It's like, more Star Trek, burp, put on another new show that I've never seen before.
when we come back from our break, I want to ask you about the animated series as well. And cool. Continuing art stuff.
All right, cool.
Yep, good transition, Keith. And we'll go to a quick commercial and we'll be right back.
Lighter here, inviting you to join Cletus Jacobs and I every week as we dive deeper into the dawn of DC. We review DC comics, television, movies, and more. We're excited to finish the final season of Doom Patrol, return to Sweet Tooth for its second season, and check out the Netflix series Bodies. Get all your DC news on the Earth Station DCU podcast, part of the ESO Network.
I laugh every week.
Pretty cool. I like that. Yeah. We're
back. I laugh every week. So, Mark, a question I had, because I don't know a lot about art, but you know, your artwork is phenomenal. One of the things I wonder, given the time that you came up, that was the time of wild science fiction. You know, like you said, Lost in Space. It was the time of psychedelics. It was Land of the Lost. It was Lidsville. It was Sigmund and the Sea Monster. And then
I'll tell you some other things. There was two huge Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Planet of the Apes. 2001 for the smart people. I sat there in the theater going,
Logan's Run.
But later, Logan's Run. Logan's Run. Great stuff. It was, it was its own science fiction, happy, joy, sort of thing going on there, too.
Oh, there was so much aesthetic stuff going on. There's the look of UFO and there's the look of the spaceships and invaders. There's the look of the cars and the costumes in UFO. And how much of that stuff influenced the way you develop your artwork? Because you're really, really, really good at what I guess is portraiture.
Sort of, yeah.
I mean, yeah. So did that influence you at all? Because, like, did you draw a lot of spaceships and Frank Frazetta barbarian queens back in the day, or no?
No, Frazetta came actually a little later for me. Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to throw out there too was stuff like George Powell movies, which is
Lord, yes.
a cousin to Star Trek. And as you know, Forbidden Planet, which is right. like
yes.
the
first
episode of Star Trek just before The Cage, which, you know, but and another one, a fantastic movie, which is a good that I said, Fantastic Voyage.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Body with a submarine. I mean, I saw that at the age of 5 and I was like, in the theater, my dad took me to see it. Oh, it was amazing.
Loved it.
And so I started off with the comics, which is linear, mm-hmm. and maybe I would open up the newspaper and there'd be like a Dick Tracy comic and I'd mimic it, or a Blondie and Dagwood, whatever, you know, just.
And those are very unique styles.
Yeah, very style.
Tracy, yeah.
But then when I started working from like photographs, like I said, with the Stephen E. Whitfield book, Star Trek book, that was like a photograph. Okay. And it was one specific, and I'm sure both of you guys have seen the book fairly regularly in your lives or whatever, but there's a shot with Kirk. I think it's Shatner and DeForest Kelly looking at a script and he's looking down. And that was the first portrait I did of somebody from a thing. And I'm like, there was a connector somehow between that. And that started me with faces. And anytime I would do a face and it didn't work, you wouldn't know it at first. You do it and you go, okay, I think I got the eye right and the nose right and all that. And then you put it away. You go back a couple hours later, you come back as the audience and you look at it and go, oh no, I can't show the world that. And you tear it to shreds and throw it away. I remember bringing in a huge drawing I had done of Charlton Heston from the Omega Man with a machine gun. And I was like, and I walked in and I showed it to my teacher who had talked about seeing the movie the night before, but I hadn't looked at it for a few hours. And I opened it up out of the folder and he goes, oh, is that from Charlton Heston from the Omega? And I took it. I just tore it up right in front of him. Like, nobody's allowed. I'm like the guy who's got the mutants that are downstairs in Island of Dr. Moreau or something, you know, they must be kept away from the world.
Yes.
I say that to Veronica about stuff that I do, graphics and things like that. Mm-hmm. It starts to suck when I'm not looking. If I'm not careful, I'll come back to it and it sucks now.
You need people that'll take your rage. I mean, that's the only way how to say it. Sisters, my girlfriend, buddies you call on the phone who've got some art background, and you send them something and they go, and just look, I have been looking at this for so long, I'm bleary eyed. Could you tell me if there's any problems? And when they start to tell you, you don't want to kill them. And everything like that. And it's like, but with like my girlfriend, Linda, it's like when she looks at it, she goes, I'm not going to tell you anymore because you get really mad. It's like, but if we get it right, you get more money.
Okay, I'll tell you.
But, you know, it's hard to hear sometimes, but sometimes you just got to hear the truth. Yeah. Or, I mean, I had a Princess Leia, Slave Leia that I did one time, and it was like, yeah, that's it. That's going to sell. My sisters looked at it. Face looks a little off. Linda, the face looks a little off. In the garbage. I'll try again later, you know?
Yeah.
But you were asking about the animated Star Trek.
Yeah.
Which is a jump back over to linear drawing. What I mean by that is more like comic books.
Absolutely. Filmation.
That show is amazing. It is now that I'm on a TV show I'm on a podcast, which is televised live. Hi, everybody. DePatie Freeling. Who were the guys? Who was the company that did it?
Filmation.
And it's at DePatie Freeling. Is that their names right? The little circle that would go around at the end.
Lou Schimmer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Lou Schimmer.
And they had done a bunch of other shows.
Lord, had they ever.
They really did. But I'm going to tell you.
The horrible Ghostbusters.
This is their jewel in the crown.
It's a good one.
It really is. Did they later do the Flash Gordon one that came out a few years ago? Flash
Gordon one's good.
And it's great.
They actually used rotoscoping on that.
Yes. I just watched Flash Gordon, that cartoon, last year. That thing holds up. They got better because they also did the Tarzan cartoon back in that day, the Lone Ranger cartoon.
The other day about the Lone Ranger, and there's some parts where he like moves into action that they rotoscoped. to make it more. I mean, it looked a little Ralph Bakshi-ish, actually.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite films, my favorite Ralph Bakshi film being a movie called American Pop. If you ever get a chance to see it,
I've seen that. Yeah,
love that's a good that one. Movie. But back to Star Trek, real science fiction scripts.
Yeah.
All the actors are back except for Chekhov, and even he wrote an episode, I think, or he wrote one or two.
He wrote The Elephant Vulcan.
Yeah.
That's a good one. And I actually like that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where when I started watching it, first episode, which there was an argument going on between people, and they actually, somebody said what the first episode was on in some book or whatever, and I'm like, no. The very first episode, the first day that it came on, was Beyond the Farthest Star.
Mm-hmm. Which I love. Yeah.
I love it. It is a traditional Star Trek story. Yeah. But other people said, no, the first one was the one where Mr. Spock goes back in time. That's not the first episode.
Mm-hmm. No,
I mean, I remember with people about that, but I remember I was there first day, first show.
Me too. Yeah.
And well, the other one's a great episode too. What I'll give to them that they were able to do in there. Sometimes we joke about it. Me and buddy, we used to call it kind of Star Trek the slideshow because it is very limited animation. But it still looks really good. And it's one of those where if you walk in, go in going, we know the budgetary limits that they have, deal with it, you're going to have a very good time.
Yeah.
But what they had that the original show didn't have is they were able to do very good looking planet landscapes, beautiful cities, you know, they had some matte paintings on the original show, but this one could always have some cool backgrounds, very cool looking monsters, and very well thought out. I mean, they had all this, you know, like crags and textures in their faces and stuff. Somebody really worked on it. It wasn't just okay, let's have a dragon or, I mean, they would have like, you know, I just thought they were really beautiful. The episode, the Kazinti episode, Slaver Weapon, excellent. Well,
probably my favorite of that entire series.
Really good. Yeah. I mean, another one that I really love, what was it called? The Survivor, where the guy brings his hands up and then they fold over and he's actually this
Carter Winston.
A Vendorian.
I mean, I'm looking at that going, this is pretty, I mean, so what I started doing is when they republished the Star Trek Concordance and they used a lot of the black and white line work in the book. Does anybody remember that? Keith, you probably remember that. There was an original Concordance, and then there was this, that was a fan thing that was really cool. But then in the bookstores, you'd walk in and there was this thing with the dish and you would rotate it and it would have information on it. But they used a ton of stuff from the animated series because that was the hot thing at the time. And I started really looking at that book a lot. And I'm like, they've thrown everything out that isn't necessary. And they've got this line work that this arm is doing this. This head looks like this. There was no shading or anything. And I actually had the book at my art school. I had just gotten out of high school and I was supposed to do an art project. It was all made up stuff, but you had to act like it was a real job. And I did a Florida State University Halloween thing with a werewolf. And my entire thing was, I'm going to draw the basic shape of it is going to be like from that style, that Star Trek style.
Interesting.
So I've got, but then later I had to fill it in with paint. And it was one of those where it came out and it looked like it belonged in that universe. That's why having drawn like this for 52 years now, I think I've been drawing over half a century, I can do cartooning. I can do, acrylic. I can do digital. I can do serious. I can do comic book and all that stuff. Although the stuff I'm most known for is what I do the most. I'm more comfortable with that. But I still look at that old animated Star Trek stuff and said, Mark, that really was a great deal of fun and a benefit to you. You know?
That's so I've got a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. I absolutely love it.
I honestly don't think anyone would ever suspect that a talented artist would cite the animated series look as any kind. Oh, yeah. Well, people who don't know art. I mean, I get what you're saying about the drawing, the lines too, but I never would have guessed that. I don't think people would guess that, you know?
I love the little details in the show too, you know, Uhura and the women beam down to the planet to save the loser men. And they show Uhura and she's standing there, standing there with the actual phaser. And I'm like looking at it on the show the first time going, oh, they nailed it. They got it just right. The tricorder, the this, the that, you know, it was great stuff. I remember one time coming back, I was in the Boy Scouts. I had to come from a 5-mile walk and I walked in the door right as an episode was coming in I'd never seen before. I was at Pirates of Orion.
Mm-hmm. No, was Orion.
On the show, they say Orion.
Yeah. Shatner keeps saying Orion and they just didn't correct us. I think he recorded that one like from a hotel room in New York.
You know, that's why I used to call anybody remember the comic called New Gods?
Jack Kirby.
I used to call the guy Orion, who was the league guy. Now I know why I did it. Now I know the damn Star Trek show.
Well, we're pro Orions on this show. We've talked about that before.
They're a great cookie. No, that's Oreos. No, I mean I remember watching that one. I walked in the door and I never said, and it was like, oh, that was really damn good. It was a good episode. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of all classic Trek. Mm. I love all of it, you know? So
when does your deep love for Star Trek start to fall out with the series? I mean, is it where there's a point past which you just don't make a point of watching them? Is it TNG, Voyager?
I got to a point where like I saw so many of Next Generation. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I'm one of those people that watched the first season probably like 5 times each episode, and everybody goes, that's the lousy season. But I was desperate for new Star Trek, and I videotaped every one of them, had them all and everything. And yeah, I guess it was the worst season, but there's still ones I'll go back and watch. I'll go back and watch Arsenal of Freedom. What was the one with the, you know, as I jokingly at the very first convention that Jonathan Frakes ever did, 101111100.
Oh, that's great. With the Binars?
Yeah, with the Binars and Minuet.
Minuet. Big Goodbye.
Big Goodbye. I mean, there was some good episodes.
Yeah.
But the show got better. And sometimes I got pulled away. The one that really stunk for me, not that it stunk, but my situation stunk, is we had the crappiest TV people down here in Tallahassee, although I am in Atlanta talking to you guys right now, or Roswell, is that they had, they kept moving. It was the one Star Trek show in our town. They actually showed at night, even though it was syndicated. And I was watching it from the beginning, but I worked nights, and they started moving it. They started moving it around.
Yeah.
I completely lost contact with one of it. I didn't even know whether the show was on anymore. I had a satellite or something. I don't remember. But it was one of those where they were moving it, and I didn't see it until it was almost like to the last, second to the last season. I definitely saw the 2-part Worf one where he comes on. Oh my gosh, I still love that episode where he comes in and he's come from Next Generation over to Deep Space Nine. I love that episode. At that point, it was the most expensive television episodes of all time. They put, I think it was like $3 million for 2 episodes or something, which, you know, nowadays that's, you know, nothing. But at the time, that was a lot of money. And so I bought and I own the Deep Space Nine all the way through.
Okay. So you're a fan.
Yes, but I haven't seen it. There's so much of it I haven't seen.
Oh, okay.
And yet one of these days I got to sit down and watch it. I'll probably just watch it through streaming because I got this set up there, but you can always put it on Paramount. But that one, and I saw a ton of Voyager. It isn't the fact that I didn't not watch them, and I watched a bunch of Enterprise. It was that it was higgledy piggledy. Sometimes you could get there and watch an episode and sometimes you couldn't. And so I always go back to, you know, sort of like the Beatles, you sort of go back to, you know, the early 60s. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I just like the tempo and the beat and the energy of the first ones.
Yeah.
Some Star Treks of later after that, there were some episodes that were way too wordy for me. Yeah. There were some masterpieces that people don't talk about. The one where Data was like supposed to be, the woman was supposed to be in love with him. He was supposed to be in love with her. And she looks at him and goes, I just don't think we should be together anymore. And he goes, okay, well then I'll delete the appropriate program. And
yeah, that's the one where he was actually recording a log to Bruce Maddox.
Yeah. My brother. Yeah. Maddox.
Yeah. All right.
So anyway, but it was one of those where that episode blew me away. It was one of those almost like Twilight Zone twist endings where I can walk away from this 100% completely, which human beings aren't used to.
Mm.
And for him to do that and still be petting the cat in the dark at the end is just sort of like, wow.
Yeah.
And she's devastated. You know, even though she's breaking it up, he can go, okay, I'm finished. That was brilliant. What was the episode of, I had to cherry pick them. Sometimes I go up online and say best of in people's opinions. What was the episode in Deep Space Nine with Sisko's son, the time travel one with Tony Todd?
The Visitor.
Yeah.
So I cried.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I still cry.
It's an amazing episode. It is. I don't know if it's their best one. A lot of people say it's right up there, but I thought it was amazing. I had never seen it. And that was real good. The Star Trek's, you know, all that stuff. I kind of have to pick through it. But
there are two Star Trek episodes that no matter how many times I've seen them, and I've seen them a million times, I cry. It is that one, The Visitor, and it is The Offspring, Data, when he creates Lal, his daughter. And when Lal dies at the end, every single time, I cry.
Thanks for the spoilers.
Oh, sorry. You hadn't seen that one.
Oh.
Oops, sorry.
I cry when I watch Enterprise sometimes, but
for the wrong reason.
I cry when I watch third season Lost in Space. Now,
Charles is not an Enterprise fan.
You don't like Enterprise at all?
I don't. Not really. No.
I did kind of like it, but we were in the middle of the whole 9/11 thing, and the show had all that feeling to it, which to me sort of is like I'd like to kind of get away from that feeling that I've got right now, which is terrible.
Right.
I don't know. It was the first of the Star Trek shows to not make it the full seven seasons, you know, other than the original. But and wouldn't it make it five seasons or something like that?
Four.
Oh, that's even more. Four seasons.
I think they barely squeaked into syndication because I think that was enough for syndication because it used to be 100 episodes, something like that.
I don't know. I was off. I got to see some Voyager and I get to see it. And then with Enterprise, I saw some of it. And then it was sort of like, boy, I've got so much other Star Trek to catch up on, you know. And I've seen, the modern Star Treks.
Discovery, Picard, Lower Decks, Prodigy, Strange Worlds.
Yeah, the cartoons I haven't watched, although I will tell you this. That third season of Picard, man, that floated my boat.
Yeah.
I loved it.
That was good.
Charles, did you like it? I want to make sure.
Yeah, I did. I have criticisms. In my opinion, though, the cartoons are better than the live action shows currently. So if you've not seen Prodigy or Lower Decks, I would check them out.
Okay. Well, I mean, to me,
they're good.
I watched three seasons of Picard, and the first one was okay. Mm-hmm. It wasn't bad. It was a beautiful production. Same thing with the second season, but that third one, even though it's, I've heard people say, it's fan service. I'm like, yeah, but it's like the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. To me, it was good fan service.
Right.
I mean, I had a great time. I was on the edge of my seat. I watched it twice, which I don't even have time to watch things once a lot of times anymore. I was very happy with it. They did have people were different. Worf is now, you know, more gone beyond what we've ever seen a Klingon do before. Data is now, I can do this. And now he's full of emotion, but I'm like, I'm digging this. Yeah. everything's so convenient that it all just kind of all ties together real beautiful and they're all together. I had a great time watching that. And that's
likely our last chance to see those characters again.
Well, to me, and I said it right after it ended, and this, you know, probably going to get some hate mail or something for this one. To me, this was their Wrath of Khan.
Wow.
To me, this was their big, giant, here's a lot of money thrown at a Star Trek episode. And, you know, but, you know, there's episodes of the original Next Generation, like Best of Both Worlds and different stuff like that, that are great. But this one was their movie where to me, their movies, other than what was the one I really liked, First Contact, which I really liked a lot.
Yeah.
I think that this one in some, well, kind of outdid it because it was just so punchy. I was so, the jokes were really good too.
Yeah.
Usually jokes, we've gone ever since the 80s, we've had jokes, Spielbergian jokes, and then everybody tries to rip off Spielberg. And we can do the jokes too. And you're in the theater going like, yeah, okay, here comes the next joke. And now if anybody starts off with jokes in a movie, it's like, oh boy, this is going to stink. But the jokes landed. A lot of those jokes in that Picard show for me, I actually laughed, and that's good writing and good timing,
right?
For me, you know,
absolutely,
yeah. So,
well, we're coming up on the end of our time.
Wow!
And I thank you very much, Mark, for coming on, and also thank you for saying nice things about the artwork of the animated series. That's something that we've talked about a lot of times before.
Yeah,
is that. Even when, and you say that the animation was limited, and I agree, the backgrounds were incredible. And there's a lot of people my age and younger who can't get into older stuff because they didn't grow up with it.
Yep.
But I'm a big advocate of looking at not the limitations, but the artistry that went into a lot of those things.
Right.
I mean, literally earlier this evening, I was replying to someone's comment about the series Space Angel, that people get caught up on the very limited animation.
You know about Space Angel?
And you're the synchro box effect. The
Charles, are you sure you're lying about your age? The Space Angel, Alex Toth design? Mark,
I think Charles even knows about Clutch Cargo.
I do, but that was my point. Alex Toth's artwork was incredible on that show. If you can get past the limitations they had in the production.
Clutch, can you? Oh, when they
put
yeah,
glued on. They even made fun of it, and I mean, they even was it Pulp Fiction? One of those Quentin Tarantino movies. They showed one of those guys doing that. It just looks, kind of obscene.
Yeah, the Synchrovox doesn't hold up, but if you look at just the stills of Alex Toth's artwork, it's incredible.
Yes.
And I mean, sure, I think more drawing. People should look at the artistry of the old shows rather than the limitations that they were fighting against at the time.
When my kids were little. They weren't necessarily toddlers or anything, but they were pretty little. And I started showing them stuff from the silent era.
Yeah.
From the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Mm-hmm. And my kids to this day still love things like my son's favorite film for a long time was George Pal's Time Machine.
Wow.
My son's favorite episode of Star Trek, which he just said, this is the one I love. As a matter of fact, on his birthday, that was the one we had to watch, was The Deadly Years. And we had to watch Werewolf of London from 1935. I mean, that was the two things he wanted to watch that night. And it's like, that's my boy. That's my junior. But the thing is that when you're a parent and the first thing you do back at that point in time, it would have been kids are little. They want some entertainment. Put on the new Transformers movie.
Mm-hmm.
You're just going to it's just going to be that. And those older shows don't have that ADD sort of intensity to them.
Absolutely. But
my kids, I mean, my daughter and I were talking on the telephone today. She's up at the University of North Carolina School of Arts, working with people who, you know, work for Scorsese cinematographer on Goodfellas. And she's working on films and stuff. And we had a 5-minute conversation of Fritz Lang and Metropolis and the Dr. Mabuza films, which I know are a direct effect on the James Bond supervillain movies later. Mm. You know, she's had one kid that told her, she goes, any movie that's in black and white before Star Wars is crap. And she told me what she said to him, and there was a lot of confusion.
I know a ton of people who, when I tell them that I watch at least one silent movie a week, that I still watch old Westerns. I've been watching The Virginian recently. when I love 1930s monster movies and that I absolutely adore the original Star Trek and animated series. I have people who will say that, like, how do you watch black and white? How do you possibly watch a thing where, you know, you got to admit if the white sound device was a microphone. There is nothing funnier than that little poodle creature and the Enemy Within where they put the little thing on his ears, the little alien. But it's great stuff.
Hey, I got a drawing. I just finished a drawing of George Takei holding that dog because I love that thing so much. I'm not joking. I'll show it to you when you guys post this thing. I'll send you a picture of it. But I just love him standing there on that planet surface holding that dog with those two little antennas. He's probably picking up Svengoolie or something. but it's one of those things. Yeah, I mean, I love old Doctor Who with its very plastic stuff and their low budgets. It's charming, but I always say this to people. Before you start to watch a film or a television show, put on the filter for the year that it was made.
Right.
I agree.
If it's a 1920s movie, put that filter on. If it's a 1950s, 70s, whatever, you have to look at it through the eyes. I always enjoy movies from any decade or television shows or whatever. And Keith, I'm going to tell you something. For decades, I hated Westerns, hated them because that's what we mostly had at the air base in. We had a few Irwin Allen shows and then that Star Trek show came on, but most of it was all these other shows. Now I went back years later and I go, these people have everything stripped away from them. There's no chance of a monster or a plague from another planet. There's not even in the cop shows, there's not a drug syndicate or anything. It's gotta be these people's personalities and what they're doing. And everybody needs to go back to Westerns at some point in time to see people interacting with each other. And now I'm like a huge fan. I've got the Steve McQueen, Wanted Dead or Alive, Rawhide, and all that kind of stuff. And those are words that did not cross my lips until about 20 years ago. They would have never. I love The Searchers. There's a ton of movies I love, you know. And we're kind of lacking in Westerns nowadays. I wish we had some more than what we're getting. But
agreed.
The thing with the Westerns, too, is they all had essentially the same assortment of costumes, sets, and story. It was what you write, what you bring to it with, like you said, the writing and the acting that differentiates it. You're not going to have some crazy Western town. The Western towns all look about the same. So it's really what you bring to the Western genre. It was really a great format for, you know, playwrights and people who write screenplays.
And I think that those were the guys that cleaned up those scripts were the kind of guys that got on Star Trek.
Right.
Absolutely.
Gene Coon, he would do shows. Yeah. I mean, I applaud that. And I think that when I don't like Star Trek, ooh, here it comes. When I don't like Star Trek is when it's the same thing with people that get into comics that have only ingested comics.
Hmm.
You have to take in Michelangelo. You have to take in Van Gogh. You have to take in everything. When it comes to science fiction, a lot of the best science fiction writers have got a whole heck of a lot of other things they're interested in. They're interested in Venice and they're interested in cooking and they're interested in this and that. And they're interested in the human condition. But when you just eat that and then produce it, it gets a little, you can kind of tell sometimes, right. You know, you need to be. And that's why for me, the original Star Trek is still the best because you had people that were being handed really cool scripts by science fiction guys and running it through the tunnel so that we would get the concepts, the super cool concepts, but at the same time, get the humanity and the very interesting characters.
Yeah, so true.
And because at that time, there was no Star Trek to know what Star Trek was. So they were just trying to create a good TV show called Star Trek.
Yes.
Sure.
This has been a lot of fun. Mark, I know you're in town for Toylanta this weekend and here in Atlanta for our Atlanta residents, but where else can people find you?
Well, I've got my website, Maddox Planet, MaddoxPlanet.com. That's where my stuff is. Now, I wanted to tell you guys, and I don't know if you've ever dealt with this or not, down in Kingston, Georgia, there are the Star Trek sets. Have any of you guys ever gone to those?
I've been there several times.
I have not been yet.
Oh, Keith.
I know.
Keith. Here's what I want you to do before you go down. Now, I'm supposed to go there. They're having a weekend thing on in April. It's the 13th and the 14th. Before you go, not whether it's this time, they do it. I think now they're doing it every month. I highly recommend it. But watch some of the really great ship episodes, especially for first season with that noir film lighting.
Oh, yes.
And then go. Because, and tell me when you're going to go, because I'm going to show up and I'm going to photograph you standing there going, I'm in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a Star Trek. Charles? Isn't that?
Yeah. Your brain can't handle it, especially when you're walking down the corridor and it has that curve and you can't see around the curve.
Oh,
and it's like your brain is trying to figure out what's happening. Like I'm inside the TV show. I don't.
There's photographs. I didn't even bother when I went down there. And this has been years since I've been there. It's been like 6 years when I went down there. And my girlfriend went with me and a couple of buddies. And we were standing. We were just like all looking at each other going like, we've actually been put into, it's like we've been put into the audience the night the Beatles are on Ed Sullivan. We're there. Right. We're in this Star Trek episode. We're on the transporter platform. We're in the hallway. I mean, by the time you get to the bridge, it's almost like you're almost expecting that to be so spectacular. But Kirk's quarters, sick bay, and now that apparently they've added a whole bunch more stuff on there, including the engine room, which is to scale. That's
the engine room is fantastic.
See, I haven't seen it yet, but Keith, you'll go there and it'll be like it, you know, watch some of those and then go, because it is, you don't even have to, you've probably seen them a million times, but you know what I'm saying.
I can't wait to go. I can't believe I haven't been there yet.
My daughter got fussed at for climbing the ladder in the engine room. Someone was afraid she was gonna get hurt, and I'm just like, leave her alone. She can go, you know what I mean? Can you imagine being a kid and climbing the ladder in the engine room? I'll catch her if she falls.
It's bizarre. I did not take photographs. I just ran video off of my camera at the time because I knew that I wanted every angle and everything. Yeah. I did not take photos. It was like, I want to see. And so anyway, they're doing that, and they do it monthly. And yeah, there's the Ticonderoga thing up north, but for somebody who's like wants to be in driving distance, I highly recommend it. I had a great time. And then I think on the 13th and 14th, they're going to have me there as a guest.
Wow.
So I'll probably be set up there. But I think you guys will, Charles, you already know what I'm talking about, but
oh, yeah.
Keith, you'll really love it. You will
love it. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I'd love to see you down there. And if it is that time, let me know some other time. I'll see you when you get there. We'll visit.
Okay.
And cool. You said your website is Maddox Planet?
Yes, sir.
And if anyone out there has not seen Mark's work, check it out, because his artwork is absolutely stunning. And
it really is.
He really brings these old movie characters and old TV characters to life. It's fantastic.
Well,
I would just, only thing I say is, I wish he would keep publishing his drawing of those ant creatures from Outer Limits.
Oh, my gosh. I love them.
Honestly, I'm not joking. I have opened up his Facebook post a couple of times, and I have jumped.
I thought you were going to say, I just want to say that Princess Leia's face still doesn't look right.
No, those Zentrani, whatever they call those bug-eyed ant creatures with the big teeth from
Outer Limits. The Zanti Misfits
are one of the greatest.
I finished that thing up and I had a huge print up that I was taking. This is back when I had the really huge prints at my table.
Yeah.
And I had a big print of it and my daughter had never seen it. She walked in the room.
And
the look on her, she went like that. I mean, it really freaked her out.
Yeah. One of the greatest sci-fi monsters of all time.
And what's his face?
Absolutely.
Who's the old producer? Greg Nicotero on The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Came to a convention and he bought a couple of paintings from me and stuff. He saw that print and he goes, that's mine. I mean, he loves Anti-Misfits. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great, that's a pretty wild television show for early 1960s television to get those kind of special effects on TV. A lot of work.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
Keith, where can people find more of you?
You can find me on X and Facebook, primarily the ESO Network Facebook groups.
And you can find Veronica and I at feltnerdy.com, which is the website now, or you can find us on Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or Twitter. We don't really tweet anymore, but at feltnerdy, or you can find our adult puppetry content at feltnerdyanddirty on all the social media platforms. And Veronica's not here, so Keith, do you have a closing for us this week?
Oh man, I didn't. Oh, look at me!
You're playing a Veronica.
I know. Okay, since Mark talked about the old series and he mentioned something, I'm gonna say, gonna crack my knuckles and jump for joy. Got a clean bill of health from Dr. McCoy.
Perfect. Everybody, join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking about Legacy Star Trek next week, and then we'll be getting into New Star Trek as it debuts on April the 4th. So we hope to see everybody there.
So
thank
blessed.
You for joining us.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thank you. I appreciate it, guys.
Thank you for listening to Earth Station Trek. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a positive rating. You can also send us feedback at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. You can join in the fun on our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter. You can also visit us online at earthstationtrek.podbean.com. We'll see you next time. Live long and prosper.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.